Who's intro? Are you introing?
I'll intro. Welcome to Just Another Wine Podcast.
It's bedtime stories with Jamie Good.
Sorry. I'm Jamie Good.
I'm Doug Reg.
I'm Emily Harmon.
And we all remember our names. That's fantastic.
Just we're off to a good start.
So the topic for today's podcast is around the concept of fine wine. So in the wine world, we have this term that we append to wine, which is fine. So what does fine wine mean? What is fine wine? Who gets to decide what fine wine is? And more interestingly, I think, are we seeing the emergence of the new fine wine? So, Doug, when I talk about fine wine, what does that mean to you? What, you know, as a veteran wine industry person, you know, you've obviously lived with this concept for a long time.
A veteran wine industry person.
You know, you live with it all the time, and it's
seasoned
like
seasoned wine person.
With my century-old memory of wine. Of course, when I first started in the wine trade, which was in the 1980s, early 1980s, fine wine constituted Bordeaux, Burgundy, some Moselle and Rheingau, Tuscan wines, Brunello, Super Californians, and then later like Super Tuscans, Barolo. It's all the classics, classic 70s. A few things like Grange in Australia. And yeah, and then fine wine became, I think there became the idea of that you could index a fine wine according to its price. So there's a thing like a Bordeaux index that people would follow. And I suppose writers such as Robert Parker, in a way, set pricing and set a sort of new standard of what was considered to be almost the new first growth or the new second growth or the new Grand Cru, the new Premier Cru. And all these things became received knowledge. And I think as someone who was learning about wine in those days, I just accepted them to be the truth. I didn't accept them as a sort of, I didn't like ever think I would be able to afford to drink the wines and prove them on my pulses whether these were the cases. And then when I got into more sort of like artisan natural wines, I began to think that the wines I thought were the best and most beautiful wines, these were the real fine wines. They didn't necessarily have to be unobtainable, although that always seemed to help to a certain extent, but they just had to be produced carefully in small quantities with super farming, and the evidence would always stand in the glass. And then when you tasted with another person, they'd say, that's a wonderful, beautiful wine. So fine wine for me became what's in the eye of the beholder, not what's, you know, traditionally thought to be fine. And I'm not sure I like the word fine anyway, because I don't know, it's too much of a judgment, a general judgment. It's like a hierarchical principle of wine judging, whereas what I think about wine is so particularly personal, and I know you guys probably feel the same. It's about what you feel about a particular wine and what value it has for you. But come back to Jamie's point about the new fine wines is that, yeah, a lot of the old certainties are being removed, and new, ambitious producers who are, you know, dedicated to quality, well, why can't they make the same quality of wines, if not better, than the estates that we've always held, you know, like held it to be self-evident that these were the fine wines? And I think there are two things to think about here. One, it's a price thing. Is it a price thing? Can only wines be fine if they're expensive, because that they've acquired their price due to the perception and their rarity and their desirability? Or is it just disregarding price? Are the wines in themselves incredible? And what individuals like us feel about the wines, the way we respond to them, that's what makes them fine.
Emily, what's your view on the whole concept of fine wine? What does it mean to you?
I think for me it's wines that have a level of, let's say, complexity and expression, wines that communicate something unique, maybe I'm careful, it's really difficult to actually articulate it without reducing it, but I think I don't want to say polish, because it's not about having really polished wines, but having a posture to a wine, and a sophistication to some degree, or maybe a complexity that is intriguing and interesting. I don't know if price point is, if there, I understand, because most of the things that we might assume to be fine wine usually are expensive wines. However, for example, like, one could argue some of the first growth Bordeaux houses are not necessarily fine wines. They're just technically made wines that feel a bit generic sometimes to me. But, you know, if I think of, I don't know, very, like, one of my favourite Barolo producers and in a good vintage, like, fine wines that I think that leave me to contemplate over, that leave, yeah, this resonance to them. I don't know if I could articulate it further without just sounding a little bit wanky and maybe a little bit textbook. I think I would distinguish, like, we're going to talk about that, right, about this idea of fine wine. Like, I think when somebody talks to me about fine wine, in parentheses, I think that sometimes we have a different understanding of what I like or would consider a fine wine versus what I believe the general public or the general wine trade. Like, you know, almost like the WSET diploma / MS student might consider a fine wine. I think there would maybe be a Venn diagram where there could be some wines that would overlap into my understanding of fine wine, but I think we would have a really different expectation and understanding of what that is, because I think there's this historic, like Doug said, this historic idea of what a fine wine is that was very much defined by critics, but also this sommelier, like, wine club community of, like, I mean, it was almost predictable that you're like, oh, okay, I'm gonna go to a West End hotel, and then there's that wine list where there's the Dom Perignon, there's the Sir Winston Churchill, there's the Salon Champagne, there's all of this sort of stuff that was like ticking all the boxes of, like, I'm a good sommelier and I've bought those wines in good vintages and look what I've got, and, you know, all the Felton Road Pinots. And it's not that those wines are not necessarily good wines or that they're all terrible, but it's just a bit formulaic, and I think there's way more interesting stuff out there. And I mean, for example, Ikonomu, I think cult classic, one of the most intriguing producers from Crete in Greece. Most people have never heard of it, but I consider many of the wines that he makes fine wines. But, like, would that fit into the sommelier or wine journalist, wine writer, wine judge view of fine wine? Probably not.
It's interesting, because the best definition of fine wine I heard was a very simple one from Hugh Johnston, which is wines that are worth writing about. So that most wines you'll come across, yes, they're good, they taste like wine, but I don't really want to start writing about them. But then some wines you come across, they prompt you to respond. There's a level of interest to them. But I think that most people's idea of fine wine isn't like that. I think most of it is this legacy of the English fine wine trade, where you've got wine merchants who, you know, you grow up in this time.
Sicilia.
Yeah, you have a certain number of wines that are bought and sold and traded and collected and have, as Doug said, a value apportioned to them because the market rates them at this level. And this is kind of a closed club to some extent. There's been some new entrants, like Napa's got some new entrants. Australia has got a few wineries that are included in this. But generally speaking, it's a very Eurocentric view of wine, and it's to do with history and tradition. And Bordeaux, you know, the good thing about Bordeaux makes some wines that just age really nicely. It's a region where the Grand Vin is the main wine of each chateau, and often they have 100 hectares, so they're making a reasonable quantity of wine each year. So everyone can taste those wines, talk about those wines, trade those wines. So they have a value, and they, you know, people collect them and actually invest in them because there's enough of a turnover.
Yeah.
So there's this whole business of fine wine. And so, you know, it's kind of like the roster is kind of full. They're not looking for new producers to join this. And Italy's never really joined this club in the same way. I mean, you've had some interest in Brunello a few years ago. Everyone's going,
I'd say the Super Tuscans have.
Super Tuscans definitely. Super Tuscans definitely have been in that party. And, you know, they're really good wines, some of those Super Tuscans, and they age nicely. And then you have some Barolos, but Barolo has the same problem as Burgundy, which is they're part of the club, but each producer making 12 wines or something, you know. So it's like, so it's much harder, and they're made in smaller quantities. So it's much harder to have that sense of what they're actually worth. And so in that sort of fine wine world, you know, and the other thing is that these wines, the fine wines kind of are defined by the wines these certain, you know, wine merchants offer to their private clients. And that some of these private client salespeople are super expert on Burgundy and Bordeaux and Champagne and Port. But then if you talk to us about South Africa, their lips start trembling because they know that they haven't got a clue.
Mm.
And so where do the other wines from outside these classic areas fit into the fine wine world? This is a really interesting question.
I think for years, the way that Bordeaux started to be made in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, and the way that Burgundy started to be made in the 90s and 2000s, really nothing to do with the history of these estates. You go back to the 50s, 40s and 30s, the wines were totally different. But there's a vogue for structural wines, like the density of wine somehow signifies that it's a fine wine, because you get more for your money, you get more flavour, more power, more everything. And I think that's, in terms of fine wine, I think that's a complete fallacy, that we've fallen in love with a snapshot of winemaking at a certain time, which is quite interventionist, valued new oak, valued alcohol, valued late, you know, rich, ripe fruit. But actually, can fine wine not be as much? Wines which have less colour, wines which are prettier. We cannot not mention the sort of like the sort of modern vogue for loving wines from the Jura. But even the red wines, even the great red wines from the Jura, it's the absence of what they have which just makes them beautiful and charming and unusual. And perhaps we should value more the unorthodox. That's what makes them fine, because it's unique. Not these copycat wines made, they could be from California or they could be from Bordeaux, they could be from Australia. I'm not denying that anything is not on the same level. I'm just saying that you'd find it difficult to distinguish between the styles made by enologists around the world. And there's often one or two enologists who are really setting the standards, and people buying the wines because they feel they have value. What Jamie said, tradable. They're tradable commodities, not really there for drinking. But what we're interested in wines that gives us immense pleasure and have this inherent sense of beauty because they're made from wonderfully farmed grapes and made with sort of a sort of sympathy, someone listening to the wine and someone really trying to express the terroir. And I think without terroir, you know, fine wine is meaningless. It's just like, it's just a manufactured product for a purpose. Whereas if you're sort of relating to the terroir, relating to the sense of vintage, and I think it's very meaningful. And then any part of the world can come into play. And any grape variety, there's a, you know, famous book, you know, written a few years ago by Janice Robinson about what are the noble grapes. And there were very few noble grapes. And one of them wasn't Chenin at the time. And you think, like, how could you write a book without Chenin or Cabernet Franc and things like that? But surely any wine, any grape variety made by any producer who really, really cares about what they're doing can be capable of greatness. And whatever price that comes out at, that is potentially the new fine wine.
So this concept of new fine wine, I think it really appeals to me. It's like we were in this place, you know, that the wine world developed. You've got this intersection of expensive collectible wines with the sort of luxury market as well, which is, we have to remember, there is a market for luxury. And I think wine, some sort of wines fit into that luxury market. So you've got that sort of element of this pre-existing, almost historical artifact of these regions became famous, these regions kind of got into the club. And it's not, you know, they make quite good wines, but are they massively better than the other regions and the other countries? And then you've got this expansion of people with real ambition, and an ability to make really interesting wines popping up all over the world, you know, with any region, you know, where whatever country you go to, that makes wine, you'll find some people who are super ambitious, making really cool things. And so that they kind of haven't got the entry ticket to the club of fine wine. But what we're seeing now is, or what I would define as the new fine wine. So like, for instance, you know, we get together, the three of us with other people, you know, and Emily often initiates these dinners where we all bring a couple of bottles of wine and we share the wines. And it's a beautiful experience. But what I'm finding is that we just don't bring those classic fine wines, in inverted commas. We bring things that are...
It's almost weird when someone brings one, isn't it? Because yeah. It's like, oh, there's that.
It's not that we don't believe in the greatness of Burgundy, the greatness of Bordeaux, and, you know, that. It's not that we don't acknowledge that these wines are amazing and fantastic. It's just that we've been prospecting and finding cool things and also maybe stylistically slightly different things. And there's a new, you know, I think about our friendship group, but also most of the people in the wine trade I know, they have a new aesthetic, and that new aesthetic isn't chasing depth and concentration and boldness, and it's chasing ethereal beauty that's, you know,
I mean, purity, and it goes back to actually the definition of what fine is, right? If you think of a fine fabric, is it something that's really thick, or would you think of something that is more delicate and maybe even lighter to touch?
Well, it comes back to what I was saying earlier about transparency, although it was in the previous podcast, by the way. But yeah, wines that really show themselves to be what they are. And that sort of singularity is what I think we're looking for. And, you know, a beautiful singularity, something that impresses us. Yeah, when you do get together, it's amazing how interesting the wines are. Even if you don't like them, you think like, wow, they are so much what they are. Whereas I think the more constructed wines, what I said earlier, they could be, you know, it's like winemaking by numbers. And there's any amount of money has been thrown at the wine to make it sort of like give it broad shoulders and an oak coffin. But in the end, it's just identical wine. No matter how much you think that that's good, it's well made. That's what you're saying, is well made. And well made doesn't mean it's fine. I think, you know, any enologist can make the wine properly. It's like what grabs your interest. And I think, you know, the more we drink wine, the more we're looking, you know, we can get jaded, the more we're looking for something which is surprising.
I think going on to your definition or approach to the new fine wine, the wine we've got in our glass today definitely is, I would say, a symbolic winery for that definition. So we're drinking a bottle that Doug bought, right? So it's El Tamboril 21 from Kamado G, which now today would go in Navatel Gordo, right, in the new vintages.
So basically they reclassify Commander G, Danny and Fernando, they reclassified their structure. So Naval de Gordo is the village.
Yeah, but that, what I'm saying is El Tamboril you wouldn't get a current vintage of because it doesn't exist anymore as a wine. It would go into Navatel Gordo.
No, it's, we would have 23 actually of this. Naval de Gordo,
I thought it was called Navatel Gordo. I thought they don't.
No, Naval de Gordo is the sort of village level. So if you think of Burgundy, for example, you'd have like a Bourgogne Rouge, you'd have a Gevrey Chambertin, you'd have a Gevrey Chambertin Premier Cru or Premier, and you'd have your Grand Cru, and El Tamboril would be one of the Grand Cru, like the five Grand Crus, or tiny vineyards, which are emblematic of incredibly specific terroir. So this is one of the highest vineyards they work with, around 1200 meters I think above sea level. Commander G standing for Garnacha.
It's also one of the coolest spots, right? Yeah, like it's north facing. You see that, the spiciness, the lower alcohol.
Yeah, and it,
but this is a beautiful wine, isn't it? It's that you need. It's got drinkability, it's got poise, it's got elegance, it's got a bit of spicy structure. This is a complete wine, and this sort of wine gets me excited. I get excited about this as super famous wines, you know. It's like a, and I think this is what's changing, is now there's a lot of people getting excited about wines like these. And that's really refreshing, because in the past, Spain, what was Spain's Spanish fine wine? It would be like some of the fancy Riojas.
Concentrated.
And then Vega Sicilia, you know, it's like, God bless them. But
red wine soup.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, this is this is kind of okay, but now we're seeing so many exciting things coming.
This is the antithesis. I was telling Jamie, we've got an event coming up in May where Danny and Fernando are going to come over and present Grados, not just their wines, but all the new young growers.
Can we go?
You're both invited. And it's a masterclass. But the idea, and you know, they brought out this book called Grados Calcicata, Grados. It's such a wild and beautiful place. It doesn't look like places where vineyards... I mean, there may have been vineyards there for hundreds of years.
It's like Jurassic Park meets Star Wars.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's exactly what it is. Mm. And you think it's sort of... These wines have been carved out of this glorious landscape. It's not typical cultured, it's the opposite of Bordeaux. They love Garnacha. Mountain Garnacha is like Pinot Noir to them, so they want to produce wines that have an inflections, but not like, there's no aggressive vinification. It's all in cement or in 500 liter barrels. It's all old, it's all slow, it's no punch downs. It's infusion winemaking. This style of infusion winemaking rather than extractive winemaking, to me, these are the new great wines, because the depth and the pleasure at the same time. Look at the colour. You can't see it, listeners, but it's light, like Pinot Noir light. It's shiny, and as Emily said, it's a high vineyard, so you can almost taste the altitude and also the minerality, this granitics. Saltiness, the quartz or whatever is in the soils just lifts the wine to another level.
I also love their approach to how they talk about the vineyards, of like certain ones that have like more of an Atlantic or Mediterranean influence because of the plants that are growing nearby, because they're quite special mountains and they look really different to any other European mountains that I've been to. Just one, how they visually appear, but the kind of plants and trees that you see growing around. And I think I always get this, I see it in this, obviously there's the spiciness, but this like delicate hint of caraway in the background, like this sort of sweet aromatic lift that's just there, that's for me really, really charming and very typical of Commando G Grenache as well, like really beautiful.
And isn't that the stunning thing about like certain wines is that they so reflect even these like subtle nuances of place, which is why they make all these like Grand Cru wines, you know, and you taste them, you think, yeah, they're totally different, like the best Pinot Noirs. But I know people like to say, that's a typical Saint-Julien, that's a typical Pauillac, and I think, like, what are you talking about? These vineyards are pretty homogenous. There isn't, like, the life and the diversity. And surely what we value when we're drinking fine wines is something unique, like the irreplicable. You know, it can only be there, that place, that time. And I think these wines really exemplify that.
Yeah, so this is...
High altitude infusion Grenache.
Yeah, it's a good example of how the wine world has changed for the better, I think. Now, there's enough people who recognise the quality of these wines that we could happily say this is a fine wine.
And these guys actually were like pioneers, because they were at the forefront of new wave Spanish wine, which is super exciting.
Well, who had heard of Grados? I mean, they started in 2008. Who heard of Grados really till 5-10 years ago? No one. Mm. You know, so it's been an epic thing. And what I like
I bought them in 2012.
Yeah, okay. Emily, you were fine wine before anyone else did.
No, but David Caniadas is the buyer, right? He was like, we're going to get these next month. You need to taste them. I think you're going to love them. And I remember tasting being like, these are really interesting. So I knew you'd love them. So I was very lucky that I had him like knowing my taste and got to taste them early. But
It's funny how it's quite funny, Jamie. I think it's a few like-minded people. They decide they love a wine, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, like then other people like it.
Well, you reach critical mass at that point, don't you?
Yeah, and then you know it's great that the critics also love the wines, but that doesn't make the wines for me. It just
the critics sometimes they're like they trail behind the people on the ground a little bit sometimes. And there's a lot of critics I find that they're not willing to go big on a wine until other people have gone big on it.
Because they could risk their reputation as a critic.
They're afraid they don't trust their gut, you know, enough. And they're not prepared to go high on something until... So I see this all the time with new producers that come out. And like sometimes I taste them, I think it's amazing. And I see the famous critics sometimes like hold back a little. You know, they're like, this wine's better. You give it 93 and this is definitely a 95 or more. And you just hedge your bets because no one's reviewed the wines before, and I think that's really bad. But I think ultimately what we see in the wine world is this openness to newcomers who are making really cool wines. There's enough people prospecting for the cool things that the cool things find their way to the forwards, and then maybe the critics join in afterwards. It's like a...
And that's what sends the price northwards, unfortunately. I mean, that one of the beauties is to discover a wine before it becomes famous and just love it. And then you see it on a lot of wine lists because word of mouth is really strong. And then there's such a point is like, no, critics say, now this has value. We're going to give it value. And suddenly, you know, before you know it, the wine triples in price and becomes less affordable.
So what do you think is the other, like Kamado G, all three of us are sold on that being a new fine wine. Other new fine wines.
I think what's happened in South Africa has been very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's lots of producers who have emerged in South Africa without not necessarily a huge track record. But, Evan Sadi is the most famous. He started, you know, making his own wines, the Columella and Palladius, and then the old wine series. Yeah. Butch, yeah, Chris Alhite. Making some amazing wines.
Would you Restless River? Would you count them?
I think Restless definitely fine wines. Yeah. So the South Africa's got and Peter Allen Finlayson, Chris Darlam, oof, amazing. We've done
and the Gabriel's Kloof wines have got better and better.
They're
so good.
Actually, they're like
the Syrah, like with
they're on a par with some the best in and Damascene as well as and obviously Duncan Savage, amazing wines. You know, there's so many really cool things happening in South Africa.
Yeah.
And I think they're fine wines, but it's about other markets. Then the US has been very slow at recognising the best of South African wines. Really slow, because actually there's some really cool things happening here. And I've actually got one that we can taste together. Ooh,
that's a good segue, yeah.
Yeah? So if you can clear your glass.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's a shame to do that, but yeah.
Yeah. So this is...
Quite a way commanded you, honestly.
This is Syrah. It's made by a producer in Franschhoek, but the grapes come from Swartland. And this is the Buchenhutzkluf 2023 Syrah, newly released.
So it's Syrah grown on Porcelainberg, you said.
So 90% of it's from Porcelainberg, and then 10% from another site in Swartland. And obviously Porcelainberg makes amazing wines as well under the same ownership.
People that don't know... The hill of Porcelainberg is different to the rest of the terroir in the Swartland.
Yes, it's a special place. Yeah, it's a really special terroir. And
is it limestone? Is it limestone?
No, not limestone.
Why is it called Porcelainberg, though? Or it's granite? What's the soil makeup that sets it out as different?
Good question. I don't want to give the wrong information here. I think it's... when I've seen... I've been to this... visited a couple of times and it's like a schisty sort of style soil. It's more schist and slate, that sort of... But it's a very interesting place. And this, for me, I think is one of the most exciting Syrahs from South Africa. And so Mark Kent's been making Syrah for a long time. He made a very famous one in 1997 from what's now, the vineyard is now Car Park in Somerset West. And it was, this aged beautifully, but it's pH 4.2. Like, so it shouldn't have aged, but it aged so nicely, this 97 Syrah, very famous. But this is obviously from a different region. This is from Swartland.
Quite and a for different me, this style
is,
of wine.
When you taste this is we're moving in a different direction. I think if you were to taste this blind, you definitely would be heading to Northern Rhone.
Mm. It's difficult. It's difficult for me after the Kamado G that's got such purity because it has a little bit of that kind of toffee viscosity to it that I don't really like. But I think it stands out more because we've gone from something that's so transparent.
But what I like about this is there's an intensity and a focus, but a freshness. It's got black pepper. It's got a little olive savouriness. It's a rich wine, but it's got detail and purpose to it. I think this is a really exciting expression of Syrah, and this will age quite nicely, I think, as well.
I mean, weirdly, it feels it's Syrah definitely, and it's got a little bit of the fine boshy sort of character. You know, those sort of garriguey sort of notes. I guess it's odd that you always think Garnacha is more alcoholic and more powerful and more sort of middle palate. But for me, the Kamado G is more fluid, elegant. And this is darker. It does, I agree with Jamie to a certain extent, it does have this sort of like hints of the Northern Rhone, which I think a lot of South African Syrahs, I think, aimed at, because I think producers, they tend to end up making what they like to drink, which is another sort of new fine wine thing, is that this current generation, or the last generation, this generation, they like to drink different wines to their ancestors. You know, they don't have the sort of certainties. They have different things. They travel a lot more.
Maybe, but also the Commando G is also inspired by a Southern Rhone wine, Chateau Reyes. Danny and Fernando always have said that was the best Grenache that they ever had, and that was like their kind of, let's say, light that they were following. And quite interesting that we tried two Rhone-inspired wines technically, but...
Yeah.
Present like created and presented in very different styles, but
I felt their wines felt like Southern Rhone Grenache, other than the grape.
But Chateau Reyes is like Reyes very is fine. Elegant and...
Oh yeah, sand, yeah, but, and... but definitely Pinot-esque for me. Yeah. Like
Burgundy. But Reyes Châteauneuf is Pinot-esque for the appellation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah. there's so much that is different from the terroir. It's like entirely different, and also. Well, yeah, the terroir and the winemaking.
back to our point, though, which is really not necessarily a style comparison. It's about who gets to join the club. And I think that Bourgogne Exclusive Syrah, I think, it's a fine wine for me. I think the Tamboril from Commander G is an insanely fine wine for me. It's like we're seeing these new entrants, and they all deserve to be part of the discussion the other question I think we'd have when it comes to fine wine is, does fine wine need to be ageable? So with the Tamboril, maybe that can age. It's 21. But does it need to age? No. This is like, I don't think that you've got so much to lose.
Aging wine can be a bit of a fetish
This is so delicious now. It's like, if I had this, I would open it and drink it. I wouldn't stick it away for 10 years.
Probably also could.
You probably could, but I don't know if there's much of an upside. And like with a lot of the South African stuff, it's like you can age it, but you're not getting anything better with 10 years in the bottle.
No, what's wrong with
some of these wines are just ethereal and beautiful, especially the lighter style ethereal beautiful wines. This is one of the reasons why I really came to love natural wine, because you're getting at an early stage in a wine's life something that has all the complexity and the layers and the you know, wide dynamic range of flavours that a beautifully aged wine has, often early in its youth. I'm not saying they don't age, because it's natural wines age beautifully, but it's like it's delivering you an immense pleasure. It's not like Bordeaux was like, the joke about Bordeaux is like, you're trying Bordeaux, you go, oh, this needs another 10 years. And then it's like, and then the next bottle you say, well, that should have been drunk 10 years ago. It's like you never find that minute in the wine's life where it's actually showing at its best. You're always talking about, it could be better, or it may have been better in the past. It's like, well, where is the drinking window there? Whereas Riesling is very interesting. Because Riesling, I think, it's like Riesling drinks well young and drinks well old. Like really good Riesling, and like Mazel, you know, Riesling. It's like there's a, and it's like not just survival, but development. And this is the thing about fine wine. Obviously, the tradition of fine wine has been that in the past, people used to sell their wines because... unless you sell them, they weren't very nice. That was the very old Bordeaux sort of way of doing things, is you'd have a well-stocked cellar and you'd bring out the mature wines because they're ethereal and beautiful.
But I think this is the shift that we're saying, right? Is it's not, it's this, let's say the old, like the 2000 sommelier, where they'd be buying this sort of textbook wine that was very typical, that was made perfectly to like fit a box and a price point, right? And maybe had the ratings and everything else, to this shift, to this new understanding that we're kind of saying that we understand to be fine wine today, is this idea of a singular style, like a wine that has this unique quality. It doesn't necessarily need to be a wine that's for aging, but it's a wine that has this resonance, this remembrance, this... I need to pay attention to this. This is really intrigue.
The Hugh Johnson definition is so far the best, because it's, whatever we say, we come back to this. Is this wine worth talking about? And if it is, well, I think it's fine wine. You know, this is, you know, I think this is a really nice way of doing it that gets away from the the complexities of, oh, what's the market value of the wine? Is it going to increase in value? You know, is it collectible? Is it tradable? We escape all that by reducing the discussion.
Does we're in a different place to where we were when I started, like, working and tasting wine. So we're two or three generations on. So, you know, like, people would drink and value red wines. White wines were slightly frivolous, basically.
And maybe just having a certain appellation would feel prestigious.
Yeah, and basically, you know, pretty well all Bordeaux, as long as it was a Cru Classé. And what we valued in these wines was the secondary, the sort of like the move from the sort of into the decay, the sort of the secondary aromatics of Bordeaux and Burgundy and Rhone. That's what made the wine great. They acquired like another level or layer of flavour. Now, we drink most wines a lot younger and we want to drink them younger. Funnily enough, I think, well, not funnily enough, but we drink a lot more white wine, and I'm talking about all of us. I think the diet has changed. White wines definitely precede red wines. And weirdly, white wines probably age more interestingly than modern red wines, because modern red wines are made more for sort of early drinking. So I think winemaking has changed. People's tastes have changed. Of course, winemaking reflects people's taste. Of course, there's like a whole different parameter for what we consider fine wines, because, I mean, for me, years ago, I never considered anything other than a few Burgundies to be fine wines. But now, in my pantheon, a lot of whites would be the fine wines. They're the wines that stick away. They're the wines that develop more interestingly around the structure of the acidity and so on and so forth. I don't age them to age them. I age them to surprise me, to see what they will be like. And I'm always blown away. But red wines is like, I think if, as soon as they die away, I regret not drinking red wines earlier. And, you know, I can see the colours faded, the fruits faded, the interest has faded. And I think, why did I do that? Because my perception of them was red wine's going to last longer. It's a fine wine, isn't it? But actually, no, that's not the case anymore. Those certainties have completely been replaced by new realities.
I mean, back in the day as well, it's interesting because we would never even considered orange wine as fine wine. And now, I mean, since a while, there's several orange wines or skin contact whites that would go up there as fine wines to me that are very special.
I know, if you consider the work that goes into the élevage and, you know, the sort of the seriousness and the ageability, then these wines are great wines. I think, critically speaking, they're not highly regarded because it's a bit like rosés as well. They're not considered to be important in any way.
Eric Pfiffling, Tavel Rosé.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the best rosés and some of the best wines I've ever drunk in the world. You know,
well, on the Isle of Wight, we drank some phenomenal wines, which happened to be rosés. And it's like, well, why are we not talking about them in the same breath? Why do we have this? Why do we have whites on one side, reds on one side, and way in the distance, rosés and amber wines? It's ridiculous. It's like they're all wine, and every wine on its merits. And the care and the love you put into making a great wine comes out in the end in the bottle. We don't need to have the snobbery that we once had. You know, we don't respect critics and hierarchies in the way we once did. Most of the following generations didn't go, you know, consult the Bible according to whichever wine critic it was to get their received information. They make up their own minds, basically, and hopefully taste will win out in the end. And it will democratize wine a lot more, so that producers making great wine in South Africa who are off the radar, they will be considered, you know, to be fantastic producers because the evidence is in the glass.
And then I think one interesting point, I know we're soon to wrap up, but I'd love to know if you two both have a producer, a region, a specific wine that maybe isn't regarded as a fine wine in amongst the nerdy wine community with this new fine wine definition, or that you could perceive potentially being considered as a fine wine, whether that's region, producer, wine in the future.
Well, for me, one region that strikes me as, you know, never been included in fine wine before, but now is making some really very cool wines, is Vinho Verde in Portugal.
Nice.
So up in the north of Portugal, north of Porto, in that sort of like area that joins the Spanish border, there's some amazing terroirs, some really good grape varieties, including some red grape varieties like Alvareal and things like that, that in the right hands are now making some very impressive wines. One producer, for example, I think that's part of your portfolio is Afros.
Yes.
You know, it's like, these are really cool wines. It's like, this has been exciting. So I was out there in December visiting, no, November, I think, late November, I visited a bunch of producers and I came away thinking, yeah, there's some good things here that never, you know, were just not being made in the past. This was a region making a lot of cheap wine. And now that for me is exciting. And Portugal has a lot of producers that I think are making wines at a very high level now that the market is still yet to wake up to. And for me, that's very exciting.
It's difficult. I tend to look towards cool climate regions because that's what I like drinking. So, you know, quite recently into Savoie, and I think the potential
there. I knew that. It's really great. Say it.
I just heard like something about mountain wines and the sort of thrilling minerality and the sort of, yeah, the glacial purity of them. But like you want to talk about now in the last 5 years, Sicily is definitely going to be the place.
Yeah.
And not just one region. I mean, Etna, of course, has become, I would say, the Piedmont of
Sicily. Vittoria as well.
Vittoria, yeah. With your fantastic producers and amazingly elegant wines for a region that should be, you know, south of the north tip of Africa. Mm. And then Marsala, you know, like just, even the whites, but I mean, obviously, you know, the sweet wines, but the Zabibos and Grillos, I mean, these are fantastic acidity and purity and, you know, like island wines in the best sense. So, yeah, I think Sicily is here now and is regarded as probably one of the great wine regions. But again, probably like 5 years. And now, if you talk about the main producers in Sicily, from Etna to Vittoria to Marsala, people have heard of them, you know. But the wines are, relatively speaking, not that expensive yet. There are some which have vaulted over, you know, into the high price bracket. But no one would deny that the wines are incredibly interesting.
Very nice. I would throw in the dry wines of Cadiz and Jerez that are coming out.
Yes, what an amazing story that's happening there. Yeah.
Yeah. One to watch. Very nice. Any final thoughts?
I don't know. I mean, like, I'm not pro this idea of hierarchy and talking about fine wines, but, you know, everything we talked about, I say, yeah, that's fine. That's really good. So, and I think intuitively, you know, when you taste something, you think like that deserves to be considered on the same level as a much more wine with a much more exalted reputation. And I dislike this sort of like, you know, like the hierarchy or the perception. Because, and sommeliers often are prone to this received wisdom because they think, you know what, I need to list a wine that people have heard of that has a reputation. Even if the reputation is just a PR reputation, it's not like really about the wine itself. So I'd love more people to sort of consider the provenance of the wine, you know, what goes into it, why it is the way it is. And also say that fine wines can be not expensive wines. Isn't that a wonderful thing that one could afford to buy these beautiful bottles?
Very nice. Jamie?
I think I concur. And I'm so excited about the fact that the world of wine now is much more broad and deeper than it used to be. And as I said, the what prompted me to think about this topic was when we get together with our friends, you know, we bring so many interesting bottles from different places that all deserve to be in that peer group with the very finest wines. You know, the old wine trade lunch, you'd have a lineup of bottles. You still see it occasionally on Instagram where you start with a champagne, you go to some white Burgundy, then maybe a bit of red Burgundy, then mostly Bordeaux, maybe finish with Sauternes or Port. And it's like, that's kind of it. And that's
boring.
So different now. I mean, those wines are fantastic, but there's so many wines in the peer group of these that And I kind of find it annoying for the must be annoying for the producers. They're making truly great wines that are terroir specific, kind of fine and elegant and thought provoking, and make you feel good about the world. And they're just not getting anything close to the prices of people making kind of mediocre stuff from the famous regions. So that's a kind of frustration. So it's like, maybe that will change. Maybe, you know, we don't want these wines to become super expensive, but we want people need to be paid a certain amount for their wines to be able to farm properly and take the risks that they do, as, you know, making something from an agricultural product where you're at the vagaries of nature. So I think that, you know, I'd love to see the continued expansion of the wine world to bring in new producers, because people are willing to pay a little bit more for the wines. They can afford to make really interesting wines from different places. And that, for me, is very exciting.
Well, you said the Hugh Johnson quote, like, fine wines are what you want to write about. I think fine wines are what you want to drink in the end. Yeah. So it's, you know, you don't have to, you respect them, but you don't have to, like, kneel before them.
Yeah. And on that note, we'll close this podcast. You've been listening to...
to...
Jamie Good.
Doug Rigg.
And Emily Harmon. You can find us on Instagram at Just Another Wine Podcast. Send us your questions, requests, feedback. We're open to it. We'd love to hear it. Until next time.
Bye. Cheers.
Cheers.
Sounds like Sunday at the church.
Yeah, no, it's the same. Big Ben. Big Ben just...